This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
While floating weightless in outer space at the International Space Station last spring, our first guest, Commander Chris Hadfield, recorded this version of David Bowie's Space Oddity. It was turned into a video that has gotten over 18 million hits on YouTube. Hadfield has flown 3 space missions, conducted 2 spacewalks, and spent a total of 6 months in space. He's witnessed awe-inspiring beauty, faced life-threatening dangers, and held onto a spaceship orbiting Earth at 17,500 miles an hour. Hadfield is the author of the new book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. A former Royal Canadian Air Force fighter and test pilot, he's been the director of operations of NASA in Star City, Russia, and the chief of International Space Station operations in Houston. In space, he's served as the commander of the International Space Station. Hadfield spoke with Terry last Wednesday.
Commander Hadfield, welcome to Fresh Air. I just want to start with your Major Tom video, since that's gotten over 18 million views. Talk about going
that's
viral.
That's crazy.
So, is it hard to sing and play guitar in space?
It is actually. It was subtly hard. Singing, it's weird because your sinuses never drain without gravity. It's sort of like standing on your head forever, and no professional singer stands on their head forever before a performance because it kind of fills up your tongue and your sinuses, and you sound a little bit congested. So it changed the timbre of my voice for sure. It may have actually made it easier to hit the high notes. I'm not sure. And then guitar, it's just an acoustic guitar up there. But when you move your left hand up and down the fretboard, because the guitar is floating weightless, it kind of flies along with your hand, so you constantly miss with your left hand. Clumsy popping recordings. So it's a little bit new to both sing and play up there, but with enough takes, eventually you can get something that's worth listening to.
How did you start doing videos in space about how to brush your teeth and make a peanut butter and honey burrito, a demo of how you sleep?
I started making just little, what I hope were insightful videos of, you know, how do you walk to work in Star City, Russia, or what does the simulator look like in Scuba, Japan? So it sort of set the stage. And then once I got to orbit, what really precipitated it for me was a can of peanuts. I opened up a can of peanuts, and when I looked inside, it looked like it was full of bees. And I just thought, wow, and I kind of like closed the lid again. But then I opened it again and realized it's just all these peanuts floating around in weightlessness, and it just looked so surprisingly cool. So I just grabbed my iPad and made a short, I don't know, 15-second video of nuts in a can and sent it down to the space agency, and they put it out on the YouTube site, and it's been seen by millions and millions and millions of people. And it kind of just clicked in my mind, and in the space agency's mind, of course, that if we can show the experience using technology that exists, people's interest will drive them to it, and they will actually be curious.
I just want to say thank you. I love that you've done that.
You're welcome.
That's great. So how many times were you actually out in space, out of the capsule or out of the space station?
Well, I've been so lucky to have done 2 spacewalks. If you looked at your wristwatch, I was outside about 15 hours, which is about 10 times around the world. And, you know, there's a whole time dilation.
Excuse me, I just have to interrupt. I just have to interrupt and say that's just mind-boggling.
Oh, it's even more mind-boggling if you're the human being out there doing it, Terry. It's the contrast of your body and your mind inside a little one-person, essentially a one-person spaceship, which is your little spacesuit, where you're holding on for dear life to the shuttle or the station with one hand, and you are inexplicably in between what is just a pouring glory of the world roaring by silently next to you. The kaleidoscope of it is just, it takes up your whole mind. It's like the most beautiful thing you've ever seen just screaming at you on the right side. And when you look left, it's the whole bottomless black of the universe. And it goes in all directions. It's like a huge, yawning endlessness just on your left side. And you're in between those two things and trying to rationalize it to yourself and trying to get some work done.
Now, you write in your book that when you did a spacewalk, my number one concern was to avoid floating off into space, which is a pretty major concern.
Seems like a good idea, yeah.
Yeah. So how are you tethered to, what was it, the space station that you were tethered to?
When I did my spacewalks, it was during space station construction. So the shuttle was docked to the fledgling ISS at the time. So we would always stay tethered.
The ISS is the International Space Station.
Yeah, that's right, International Space Station. Sorry for the acronym. Tethered means basically like a clothesline that you have clipped somewhere on structure. So you're either clipped to the shuttle or to the space station somewhere. There's little handrails and loops and things you can attach to. So you're always tied off so that if your hand did slip, you started drifting off into space. I mean, there's nobody could come rescue you. So you have a tether, and it reels out to about to 50 or 60 feet long if it had to. But you also wear a jetpack. Just in case that tether were to fail, you could pull down a handle on your right side. A little joystick pops out in front of you. You grab it, you turn it on, and then you can fly yourself with – it's just a simple system of a nitrogen tank and little thrusters. But you could fly yourself over and grab back onto the mothership and hopefully not drift off into space and have them, you know, name a street after you or something.
Tell us something else that you saw during a spacewalk that has nothing comparable on Earth.
I was coming across the Indian Ocean in the dark. I was riding on the end of the robot arm, so I had some time. I was actually carrying a bunch of laundry because we deployed a new piece and it had blankets on it, thermal blankets. So basically it was like riding a cherry picker back, carrying a big bag of laundry in my arm. So I didn't have much to do until the arm could get me back. Coming across the Indian Ocean, coming up in Australia, I thought, I want to look at Australia in the dark because everyone lives along the coast, starting with Perth and across, and it's like a necklace of cities. So I shut off my lights and I let my eyes completely adjust to the darkness. But as we came south under Australia, instead of seeing just the lights of the cities of Australia, we flew into the southern lights. And just like the northern lights, they erupt out of the world. And it's almost as if like someone has put on this huge, fantastic laser light show for thousands of miles. And the colors, of course, with your naked eye are so much more vivid than just a camera. They're greens and yellows and reds and oranges, and they poured up under my feet. I mean, the ribbons and curtains of it, it was surreal to look at driving through the southern lights. And I said to Jeff Ashby, who was driving the arm, I said, hey, Jeff, you got to see this, the southern lights. So the arm jerked to a stop, and they shut off all the lights in the shuttle and put their noses to the glass and looked at the lights with me for a while until we skirted across Australia and back up across New Zealand and into the sunrise.
Your longest mission was 146 days in space. I think during that one trip, you orbited Earth 2,336 times and traveled almost 62 miles. Again, mind-boggling. You probably hear
62 million miles.
I'm sorry, 62 million miles, yes. You probably hear a lot of frequent flyer jokes, so I will not bother to make any. And you see another sunrise every 92 minutes, which must be very odd and disorienting.
They happen really fast, the sunrises. Sometimes you specifically set the alarm on your watch to go watch the sunrise. And as you pull yourself down into the floor, that's where the huge bulging window is that we call the cupola. And there's the world glowing dark underneath you. And you start to see a few faint tinges of a sunrise coming as it starts to light the upper atmosphere. And then, bam, the sun just pops into view, roars into view, because we're coming around the world at it so fast. And you can actually watch the sun move away from the Earth. And the light from it initially comes through the atmosphere. So the whole station glows with the light of dawn, with all the big solar rays glow blood red and then orange. And then as the sun clears the atmosphere and it's directly on us, then they settle down to sort of an iridescent blue. And then you can see the dawn come across the world towards you. And then you go back to work and wait another 92 minutes and it happens again. It's not to be missed, and I tried to watch as many sunrises and sunsets as the work would allow.
Wow. I'm thinking of the contrast between the claustrophobia you must experience when you're in the space shuttle or the space station compared to the sense of the infinite when you're out on a spacewalk.
They don't want claustrophobic astronauts. And so NASA is careful through selection to try and see if you have a natural tendency to be afraid of small spaces or not. And really, it's good if you've managed to find a way to deal with all of your fears, especially the irrational ones. So during selection, in fact, they zip you inside a ball, and they don't tell you how long they're going to leave you in there. And so I think if you had tendencies toward claustrophobia, then that would probably panic you, and they would use it as a discriminator to decide whether they're going to hire you or not. For me, being zipped inside a small, dark place for an indeterminate amount of time was just a great opportunity, nice time to think and maybe have a little nap and relax. And so it doesn't bother me. But you can get claustrophobia and agoraphobia, a fear of wide open spaces, simultaneously on a spacewalk. You are enclosed inside your little spacesuit with a helmet and a cap on, a Snoopy cap, and some microphones right down touching your mouth, and stuff in front of your face, and your whole body enclosed. If you're susceptible to claustrophobia, that might be a trigger. But when you look outside, when you look through your visor, you are standing on nothing with 250 miles of emptiness between you and the world.
Tell us about one of the most dangerous things that went wrong during one of your spacewalks.
Probably the most dangerous time was I was operating the great big pistol grip tool. It looks like an enormous electric drill. I was tightening up some bolts, building a huge mechanical robot arm. Suddenly my left eye stopped working. And there'd been some little balls of water floating around inside my helmet, my water bag that we get drinking water of. It's like a little camelback, had been leaking slightly. But my eye just stung, you know, like a hornet had stung it or something. It just hurt, and it slammed itself shut. And I couldn't see through it. I tried to open it, and, you know, when your eye's really been hurt, you just can't open it and look through it. And I couldn't rub it because it's inside my helmet. So I thought, well, I can still hear, I can still breathe, I can still see, and one of my eyes is working perfectly. So maybe it's just a transient thing. I'll keep on working. But what I hadn't really thought through was that my eye would start tearing, crying, of course, but tears in space, tears don't fall. They just build up a big ball of contaminated tear on your eye, and it doesn't drain the bad stuff away and squirt in new tear. So I get this bigger and bigger ball of whatever that stuff was on my left eye until, unfortunately, the ball got big enough that it went across the bridge of my nose into my right eye. And now, suddenly, instantly, both my eyes are blind. And I try as I might, I couldn't get them open. All I could see was a complete blur. So now it was time to fess up. And, you know, Houston, I have a problem. And I used to work in mission control. I was the chief Capcom for NASA for about 25 shuttle flights, Capcom being the astronaut that talks to the crews in orbit. So I really understand how that room works and how the flight director and the doctors and everybody would react when I told them that I was blind on a spacewalk. And they went into hyper mode and you know, good calming voices, but coming up with lots of, you know, reactions that would try and fix my eyes or diagnose the problem. They thought maybe I had a problem where the chemical that purifies our air was maybe leaking into the suit, and some of the early symptoms are eye irritation, but it also really hurts your lungs. So they said, their first big recommendation was, we'd like you to open the purge valve on the side of your helmet and start dumping your oxygen out to space. So I'm just kind of smiling to myself, thinking, this is not how I thought my first spacewalk was going to go, where I'm blinded and now I open a hole and I'm listening to a very limited supply of oxygen hiss out into the universe. And I just kept blinking and crying and blinking and crying. And after a while, I thought maybe I could start to see just a little bit. Took about a half hour, I think. And then I finished the spacewalk. And it turned out to just be the stuff we put on the visor to make it not fog up. It was sort of like a soapy, oily kind of chemical that no fog stuff. But a floating ball of water had picked up the no fog stuff, and it's just as if I'd taken the no fog and squirted it into my eyeball.
There are so many times when I'm on my computer and it freezes, or, you know, I get that ball that goes around and around and around. Have you had the equivalent in space where, like, a really important computer just has a really like standard frustrating problem, but is your life at stake here?
Fairly early on when I was on the space station in this half-year trip up there, Terry, we were doing a major computer upgrade. And it had been tested left, right, and center and all the simulators on the ground, and we were all ready for it. And, you know, Houston said it was in our plans and everything. Here we go. Okay, 3, 2, 1, and everything quit. And the fans were shutting off, and we couldn't communicate with the ground, and all the software locked up, and nothing was working. And suddenly, we were really helpless because a lot of the safety of the space station is controlled by what we would react to on the computer. A lot of the insight we have, whether there's smoke somewhere or whether something's malfunctioning, is told to us by the computers. And we had a full lockup. And it's not just your laptop quitting and not getting to your email for a minute. It's the actual control of the whole spaceship. So not a shining moment for us as the crew. But we'd been trained for it. And so we ran around the ship checking to see the status of everything. We became sort of the canaries in the mine of knowing that our smoke detectors wouldn't work. And so racing around to make sure that seeing if there's smoke somewhere. We were coming up across the Pacific and about to cross South America. So I got on the ham radio, the amateur radio, and tried to talk to people in Brazil. So I'm listening to these guys chattering in Portuguese to each other while I'm trying to say, hey, I'd like to break in and could you please call Houston so that tell them we can't talk to them anymore and this is what we're doing. But meanwhile, Tom and Kevin and I, Kevin was the commander of the ship at the time, Kevin Ford, there's a whole backup booting sort of software that's called Mighty Mouse. And we dug into Mighty Mouse and we went into the backup procedures and we have paper procedures just in case the digital ones let us down. And it was actually a really fun moment for the crew because we trained for this sort of thing. Kevin, the commander, was behind us with the procedure. Tom and I were the two guys entering the procedures, checking through it, ticking through it. It took several hours getting ready as we came across Russia because when we came over the Russian ground sites, we could use the assets in the Russian end of the station just with a straight radio, like a VHF radio, just to talk directly. So we had our big list of questions, and Houston got ready. So when we came over Russia, there was this high-speed communication of trying to tell us what to do next, and then we went silent as we crossed over the Sea of Japan, worked again for the whole way around the world. And I think it took two times around the world. But after that, we had things fixed, got things back to life, had reverted to the old software. And then, of course, the experts on the ground tried to figure out what little glitch had gone wrong. It ended up being, you know, just a small, subtle thing, but something they could fix, and then we could upgrade the system later. But, you know, we spent decades training for what we're supposed to do up there. We have to be the geek squad, you know, and the guys that show up to fix your computer. We are those guys, so fortunately, we could deal with it.
Well, would you describe what it's like to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere?
It's like riding inside a blast furnace. You come into the upper atmosphere, and it gets to 3,000 degrees on the outside of the ship. You can see the orange and yellow flames licking around your vehicle. You can hear the metal responding to the heat. In the Soyuz, the little Russian capsule, you can actually hear the banging of the big shield, the big heat shield on the bottom as it slowly erodes away from the heat and pieces of it fly off like sparks across your window. And it's an interesting thing to ride through. You know, it makes you think, riding as this little bubble inside a blast furnace. And there's nowhere to put your heat. The ship gets warmer and warmer. And the shuttle came back because its purpose was to carry big cargo home. And we could put a huge telescope or payload in the back. It had wings, and it could come back so gently and be not much different once you'd made it through the hot part, not much different than an airliner, maybe slightly more force. That was relatively comfortable. The Soyuz, though, it's a very simple, rugged, tough little design, and it's more like riding a meteorite. And if you do it everything perfectly, you come in with a lot of vibration and about four times your weight. 4G. So after being weightless for half a year, it's really unfair to have to get squished like that. And if it goes a little bit wrong, it reverts to a mode where you don't fly it at all. It's just ballistic. And then you pull about 8 or 9G, which is, that would be hard on anybody, let alone someone who's been thinking they're Superman flying around elegantly for so long. And then the parachute opens very violently But then you're just coming down under a parachute, but you're bracing yourself for that last second, which is impact with the world. And the Russians do tell you, remember, before you land, stop talking so you don't bite your tongue off.
Oh,
that's how violent the landing's going to be. And it hits the ground. There's little retro rockets that fire, and they cushion it, but it still hits the ground like a car crash. And we land on the prairies of Kazakhstan, and so it's always windy. So you don't just come straight down and go plunk. You hit the ground, and then you tumble end over end, and finally it rolls to a stop.
How come you don't break all your bones? Because you've lost bone mass in space. That's one of the physiological changes, one of the unfortunate ones that astronauts experience. So how do your bones survive a crash like that?
They pour us a special crash seat like a Formula One driver. And it's funny, they put you in this tub and they pour gypsum in around you and they make a perfect mold of your rear end to build this crash seat from. So in the museum on the outskirts of Moscow, there's a beautiful rear-end exhibit of every cosmonaut and astronaut who's ever flown in the Soyuz, how we all looked. But they build you a crash seat that supports your lower back and your neck and your head. And then you put your hands in a position so that they're not going to flail. And your legs actually have this like a brassiere cross strap that's latched your knees down so your legs don't splay out and rip up your tendons or break a bone. And in truth, we do get osteoporosis because of the weightlessness. But we're learning how to beat it. And as I'm sitting here talking to you, I am regrowing bone. And after about a year after I get back, so next spring, I should have the same skeleton that I launched with.
I want to thank you so much for the work that you've done in space, for the risks you've taken, and for the wonderful videos that you've sent that are so enlightening about and fun about what life in space is like. So thanks for doing this interview.
Thanks very much, Terry. It's been tremendous fun, the whole thing. It's a wonderful adventure, and I count myself so lucky to have been a part of it.
Commander Chris Hadfield is the author of the new book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. You can watch the video of him singing David Bowie's Space Oddity on our website, where you can also read an excerpt from his book. That's at freshair.npr.org. Brandi Clark is a singer-songwriter from the state of Washington, who in recent years has made an impact in Nashville as a songwriter. She's written or co-written hits for acts as various as Miranda Lambert, the band Perry, and Casey Musgraves. Clark has just released her own debut album called 12 Stories. Ken Tucker has this review.
We live in trailers and apartments too. California to Kalamazoo. Grow up, get married, and when that one ends, we hate sleeping alone, so we get married again. Don't want to be buried in debt or in sin, so we pray to Jesus and we play the lotto, cause there ain't but two ways we can change. Tomorrow and ain't no genie in it, ain't no bottle, so we pray to Jesus and we play the lotto.
That's Pray to Jesus, the song that leads off 12 Stories, Brandi Clark's modestly amazing album. Pray to Jesus isn't a conventionally religious song. It sets up what will be a recurring theme throughout this collection, a quick, precise sketch of specific people, mostly rural, many of them working class, who don't see a heck of a lot going right in their lives, now or in the foreseeable future. So, as Clark sings, we pray to Jesus and we play the lotto, cause there ain't but two ways we can change tomorrow. Clark is working in a time-honored tradition, yet managing to articulate it in a fresh way.
I know I shouldn't be here tonight. I hardly know this man. Been a long time since I felt as pretty as he tells me I am. I've met him at the coffee shop, and I've met him in the park, but I've never been alone with him in this dress after. So many
That lovely melody and astringent twang vocal are in the service of a slightly sordid scenario. A married woman having an affair with a married man, or as Clark phrases it, he's some stranger's husband, I'm some stranger's wife. The clever clincher is the chorus couplet, "What'll keep me out of heaven will take me there tonight." That Jesus she was praying to in the first song is now the God condemning adultery, but the narrator just can't help herself. This willingness to sing in the persona of someone we might not necessarily like is at once Clark's signal claim to adventurousness and what's probably going to keep her album from climbing very high on the country charts.
Mama got depressed when Daddy was a dying, so the doctor gave her something to help her with her crying. Then she couldn't sleep, so he gave her something else. Now there's yellow, red, and pink on her bathroom shelf. Says if one won't work, then another one will. If you got a little hurt, you take a little pill.
Clark is working in a tradition that hops back a few decades. She comes out of the era of 1980s country women such as Reba McEntire, the Judds, Katie Oslin, Pam Tillis, and Roseanne Cash before country got too confining for her. These were among the most full-throated women staking a claim for progressive freedoms within the confines of country's intrinsically conservative social scenarios. These days, at a time when some of the biggest male country stars are literally singing the praises of women's rear ends and the joys of nonstop tailgate parties, someone like Brandi Clark comes across like a terse realist novelist, landing somewhere between Sarah Orne Jewett and Mary Gaitskell. For example, one theme that runs through 12 Stories is that alcohol may help you unwind, but it also helps things fall apart.
I did the laundry, I cleaned the kitchen, swept up the pieces of those broken dishes. I drank my coffee while yours got colder, all while you were hungover. I put on lipstick, I planted roses, painted the bathroom that you never noticed. I felt the first chill of October, all while you were hungover. Baby, your head ain't the only thing hurting, you know. The sun keeps coming up even if the curtains are closed. The girl in the mirror.
12 Stories is one of those rare albums whose every song is worth hearing. Every one is that striking, that textured, and finely detailed. It is my fervent hope that Clark, who's helped other women achieve hit singles, will have her own hits from among these smoothly crafted, emotionally rough compositions.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed 12 Stories by Brandi Clark. On November 22, 1963, Americans watching TV that Friday were hit with some shocking news.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
Though an official investigation concluded that Kennedy was killed by Lee Harvey Oswald acting alone, conspiracy theories about the assassination spawned almost immediately and haven't stopped coming. And while some theories may be far-fetched, polls show that 50 years after the assassination, a majority of Americans still believe President Kennedy was the victim of a conspiracy and not a lone assassin. Our next guest, Philip Sheenan, is a veteran investigative reporter whose new book, A Cruel and Shocking Act, recounts the work of the Warren Commission appointed by President Johnson to investigate the assassination. Sheenan pored over the files of the commission, spoke to many of its surviving staff attorneys, and did original research and interviews about some aspects of the case. While he's not convinced of a conspiracy to murder the president, he concludes that senior officials of the U.S. government, especially at the CIA, destroyed evidence and lied about the assassination and the events that led up to it. Philip Sheenan spent more than 20 years at the New York Times and wrote an earlier book about the 9/11 Commission. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last Monday.
Well, Philip Sheenan, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's begin with just a quick recap. Tell us, what were the events that happened that weekend in Dallas in 1963? What were the things that everybody saw and knew?
Well, so on Friday, November 22nd, 1963, President Kennedy arrives in Dallas for a motorcade, and he's to give a luncheon speech. And as he's passing through downtown Dallas, he arrives at Dealey Plaza, a small urban plaza in the city. And as he's passing through in his very slowly moving motorcade, shots ring out. And it is clear to some people that the shots are coming from the Texas School Book Depository, which is a private book warehouse that is to the right of the motorcade and behind. Within an hour, across town, a Dallas police officer by the name of J.D. Tippit is killed. And shortly after that, a young man by the name of Lee Harvey Oswald is arrested as he's in a nearby movie theater. Within hours, Oswald is under arrest and charged with President Kennedy's killing and with Tippit's killing. 2 days after that, we have Oswald killed by a man named Jack Ruby, who's a local nightclub impresario.
Right. So dramatic events. And there was the need for an investigation. The FBI would seem to be the logical entity, but actually killing a president then was not a federal crime. Murder is a state crime. How did we end up with a presidential commission looking into this?
Well, initially, the decision by President Johnson, who was obviously thrust into office at this point, was not to have a federal investigation, was to leave this to the city and county and state officials in Texas to deal with. But very clearly, in the days that followed, there were so many wild theories offered about who was really responsible for the assassination that Johnson decided that he had to have some sort of federal investigation. And very quickly, President Johnson settles on Chief Justice Earl Warren, who he sees as this ultimate symbol of integrity, to run the investigation.
Over the years, the Warren Commission's work and its report has gotten a lot of criticism, that evidence was inadequately examined, that certain leads weren't followed. And it's interesting that Earl Warren himself, who was the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court and, you know, had a real record for groundbreaking decisions in law, that Earl Warren himself was an issue. And I think probably a lot of people, you would probably agree that he was a bad choice to do this. And one of the reasons was that he had a very close relationship with the Kennedy family. How did that affect the testimony and evidence the commission was able to look at?
Well, Chief Justice Warren clearly adored President Kennedy and the Kennedy family. So after the assassination, Earl Warren is apparently shattered. He describes it as being like losing a son. And repeatedly during the course of the investigation, he makes decisions that seem to be designed to protect President Kennedy's legacy, to protect the privacy of the Kennedy family, even if that means that not all the facts are gathered about the assassination.
Well, one question, of course, was the autopsy photos from the examination of President Kennedy's body. I mean, given that there was a need to look at the wounds on the president and match that with ballistics evidence and other physical evidence that would be developed in the course of the investigation, it was important for the investigators to know exactly what the condition of the president's body was in. They never got a hold of the autopsy photographs, right?
Well, they do get a hold of them. Chief Justice Warren actually looks them over. And after he looks them over and sees how horrifying they are, he makes the decision that nobody else will be allowed to see them. That includes the other commissioners and all of the members of the commission staff. And this creates a huge division on the commission. The young staff members protest repeatedly, saying they have to have the autopsy photos because they are the essential medical evidence that will allow them to determine how the president died and who might have killed him. And ultimately, they are refused, and those photos would remain under seal in the custody, apparently, of Robert Kennedy for years thereafter.
Now, the medical evidence, of course, is critical, particularly, you know, as we later see, there were so many questions asked about whether the commission had gotten it right, whether, you know, about the directions that the bullets came from, for example. Tell us a little bit about the autopsy itself and what happened to the original notes of the autopsy.
Well, I got to say, this is one of the more jaw-dropping stories that I encountered in all this. But the night after the assassination, the Navy pathologist who oversaw President Kennedy's autopsy took the original autopsy report and all of his notes from the autopsy room and pushed them into his fireplace in his home in Bethesda, Maryland. He did this, he claimed, because they were stained with the president's blood and he didn't want them ever to be seen. But when it was discovered on the commission staff what the pathologist had done, there was huge alarm because they thought this was going to inspire conspiracy theories for years to come. The autopsy in many ways was rushed and it was bungled. And we are still dealing with the aftermath of that because so many of the mistakes made in the autopsy room that night have led to so many of the conspiracy theories about what happened to the president's body.
I want to talk about this fascinating part of the story, which is Lee Harvey Oswald's visit to Mexico a few weeks before the assassination. The Warren Commission was aware of his visit there. They knew that he'd visited the Cuban embassy. Oswald himself, you know, had expressed Marxist sympathies for years. But the FBI and the CIA withheld a lot of information from him. Let's talk about the CIA, for example. Did they monitor Oswald's movements in Mexico?
Well, it's remarkable to discover that the CIA may have had Oswald under pretty aggressive surveillance in Mexico City. There were reports years later that there were photographs of Oswald in Mexico City that the CIA had taken. There were tape recordings of his telephone calls in Mexico City. And all of that evidence would later disappear. The tapes, the CIA would say, were erased. The photographs, they would claim, never existed, even though there's a fair amount of evidence to suggest they did.
And what about the FBI? Did they have files on Mexico that they refused to share?
Well, both the FBI and the CIA seemed determined not to get to the bottom of what Oswald did. Oswald is there for nearly 6 days. He apparently has encounters with Cuban spies and Cuban diplomats and Soviet spies and Mexicans who were sympathetic to Castro's revolution, who had real reason to hope that President Kennedy's administration would be ended. And the FBI and the CIA seemed determined not to find those people that Oswald was dealing with. And the question becomes, was Oswald told by anybody or encouraged by anybody to do what he would do in Dallas?
Right. And one of the things that the commission did not know was that the U.S. government had already repeatedly attempted to have Fidel Castro assassinated.
Well, among the things that perhaps the most important thing that the CIA withheld from the Warren Commission was the fact that for years the CIA had been trying to kill Castro and that Castro, you know, might have had a motivation in killing John Kennedy because John Kennedy had been trying to kill him. And if there's anything that gets Warren Commission staffers agitated, it's the fact that that information was withheld from them because it would have raised a million other questions about what exactly happened in Mexico City.
Now, there's a woman who's at the center of the controversy here, a Mexican woman, I believe, named Sylvia Duran. Tell us who she is and why she's important.
Warren Commission staffers, some of them thought she was perhaps the most important witness who was never interviewed by the commission. She's a young Mexican woman who worked in the Cuban consulate in Mexico City, who dealt with Oswald face-to-face when Oswald came in seeking the visas and paperwork that would allow him to get to Cuba. There is evidence out there to suggest that she actually was in Oswald's company outside the consulate and that they were seen at a party, a dance party, at the home of one of Duran's relatives, and that they were there with two other young American men. And that whole incident was information that was entirely denied to the Warren Commission.
And why would that be important?
The question becomes, in Mexico City, was Oswald encountering Cubans or Mexicans who supported Castro, who hated President Kennedy and his administration, and might have encouraged Oswald to do what he did, or at least who might have known? There becomes a big question as to whether or not Oswald was talking openly about his plan to kill President Kennedy. And there is a remarkable document. It's a letter from J. Edgar Hoover to the Warren Commission, prepared in June 1964, in which Hoover tells the Warren Commission, and I believe probably pretty reluctantly, that there is reliable information that Oswald marched into either the Cuban or the Soviet embassy in Mexico City and announced that he was going to kill President Kennedy. And obviously that document, you would think, on the Warren Commission would inspire a million questions about whether or not people in Mexico City, aware that Oswald was talking about killing the president, encouraged him to do that. That document from Hoover to the Warren Commission would disappear. I've talked to staff members on the Warren Commission who are convinced they never saw that document, who are angry about that, and who say if they'd known that Oswald was talking openly about killing the president, the investigation in Mexico City would have been much, much more aggressive.
So whether or not Oswald was acting at the behest of the Cubans, there was enough information that should have raised a red flag about him.
Absolutely. Oswald in Mexico City meets with a Soviet diplomat who is in fact a KGB officer whose responsibilities included political violence, including assassination. And the CIA knows that. They know that this meeting has occurred. They know that this KGB officer is involved in political violence. Now, it may have been an entirely innocent meeting, and the KGB officer did have regular diplomatic duties. But just the fact of that meeting, you would think, would be enough to suggest that Oswald might be a danger to political leaders in the United States, including President Kennedy, then in the final stages of planning for his trip to Dallas.
I wanted to ask you, it's been 50 years since Kennedy was assassinated in November, and there have been so many theories and so many books. I wanted to go over some of the basic questions asked about the original findings of the Warren Commission and ask you whether among serious scholars and journalists these have been answered. So let me just run through some of them. One of them is the question of whether Oswald had the time to realistically fire three shots at the presidential limousine from his perch on Dealey Plaza. There was some question when they looked at it about whether Oswald had the skills or the time to get off three shots. Is that settled?
It will probably never be fully settled. The FBI had initially reported, again, based on what turned out to be a very incomplete investigation, had concluded that there had been three bullets. The first one hit President Kennedy in the back. The second one hit Governor Connally in the back. And the third one hit President Kennedy in the head, the fatal shot. But using the Zapruder film, and the Zapruder film becomes sort of a clock of the assassination.
And for folks who may not know, that's the home movie taken by a guy who happened to have a view of the president's limousine. Yeah, go ahead.
Right, and it becomes very essential evidence in the commission's work. It was pretty clear that Oswald did not have time to fire three individual shots. And if he didn't have time, that would suggest that there must have been a second gunman. With a little more probing and research, the suggestion is made, actually, and it's made by one of the Navy pathologists who conducts the autopsy, that perhaps one of the bullets actually went through both the bodies of President Kennedy and Governor Connally. And that seems to be the explanation. It seems to be a logical explanation as to what happened in the limousine, even though it would go on to become, I think, easily the most controversial finding of the Warren Commission staff.
Right. This is the single bullet theory, that one that it went through President Kennedy, exited his throat, went through Connally, exited his chest, and then hit his leg and his wrist, right?
Exactly.
Right. And do most folks accept that, do you think? I mean, serious scholars, do you think that it's the most convincing explanation of the ballistic evidence?
Well, very serious scientists, technical teams have over the years gone back and reviewed that evidence. And I think it's fair to say that most of the most serious scientists who've done this have found that the single bullet theory is the logical explanation for what happened.
I have to ask you about the grassy knoll. Folks who know the assassination scene know that as the president proceeded on Dealey Plaza, Oswald was in a perch behind in the Texas School Book Depository building, but ahead and to the right there was a little grassy hill, and folks have said for years that's where the other assassins were. Has there ever been any credible evidence of another gunman on the grassy knoll?
You know, witnesses who are in Dealey Plaza and people who are, you know, telling the truth say they – some people say they're convinced they heard the shots coming from the grassy knoll. There is one witness who seems to be pretty credible who describes smoke rising from the grassy knoll. But just as many people, and more people, in fact, say that they think that the shots come from the Texas School Book Depository. And one thing you learn, again, in doing a little research on this, is that eyewitnesses and, you know, ear witnesses, people who claim they hear something, they are so often wrong, well-intentioned but wrong. And there was no physical evidence obtained from the grassy knoll that would point to another shooter. And, you know, there were people on the grassy knoll. You think that somebody might have seen a man with a rifle shooting towards the president's motorcade.
When the Warren Commission, you know, found Oswald acted alone, was that accepted by, you know, important public figures like President Johnson, like Robert Kennedy, the president's brother, like all of the members of the commission?
Well, it is astonishing to discover that President Johnson, at the end of his life, did not accept the findings of the Warren Commission. Johnson thought that Castro killed President Kennedy. Robert Kennedy's role in all this is very troubling because he repeatedly said that he accepted the Warren Commission findings and he believed Lee Harvey Oswald had acted alone. And that appears never to have been the truth. Robert Kennedy Jr. just this year, earlier this year, announced that his father thought the Warren Commission was wrong and that his brother, President Kennedy, had been killed either by the Cubans or by the mafia or even by some group of rogue CIA agents. And Senator Richard Russell, who was a member of the Warren Commission and at the time the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he also did not believe the Warren Commission report, even though he signed it.
Well, Philip Sheenan, I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Philip Sheenan spoke with Dave Davies last Monday. Sheenan is the author of A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller, known for the viral YouTube videos that he's made in space. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.